Are you a carnivore? Or maybe an ovo-lacto-vegetarian? A frugivore? A fruitarian? Do you consider fish flesh in the same terms as cow and rabbit fillets? What about a veggie dog or a Beyond Burger? Meaty questions indeed. Maybe you'll have a bone to pick with me in 25 minutes or so. That is, provided I've trimmed enough fat in this audio. Thanks for joining us on this, the first full episode of Digesting Food Studies, a series that dives into some of the big ideas from a most deliciously expanding field of scholarship and teaching. This podcast is for everyone who wants to turn food systems research into on-the-ground action, whether you're in a classroom, a field, a conference room, or a kitchen. I'm your host, David Santo. On today's show, we focus on the meatiness of meat. More specifically, the discourses, practices, habits, and assumptions that become entangled within meat production and consumption, as well as, of course, the food ways that eschew animal eating altogether. This episode draws on Volume 11, Issue 1 of the academic journal Canadian Food Studies, published in March 2024, and featuring a themed section called Introducing Meat Studies. We kick things off as usual with Alexia Moyer's Amuse-Bouche segment. Together, she and I discuss some of what's involved in the last 30 centimeters in the meat production chain. You know, the distance between your plate and your mouth. Alexia shares some well-aged literary and implementary references, and we're hoping it will whet your appetite for more, whether you're a vegan, a paleo eater, or an omnivorous flexitarian. Then I talk with Ryan Phillips and Elizabeth Abergel, our guest editors for the CFS theme section on meat studies, and we take a top-level view of the field and its many systemic and disciplinary intersections. All right, Alexia, here we are. First amuse-bouche of the season. Episode 1, Meat Studies. We're going to be talking later on with Ryan Phillips and Elizabeth Abergel, the guest editors of our special themed section on meat studies. But before we dive in, what are you going to amuse us with this week in terms of our cultural food object related to meat?
Well, I thought we'd begin not with the meat itself, but with the implements we use to transport meat and other foodstuffs to our mouths.
Okay, so like utensils, fingers, chopsticks?
Yeah. Spoons, knives, and forks.
Nice.
The tools that we use to facilitate this transition. And our guide through this is Margaret Visser.
I love Margaret Visser.
And this one is The Rituals of Dinner.
Oh, one of the greatest food books ever written, I think.
And what comes across in Visser's writing is the relational aspect of meat in particular, but also vegetables and grains. So the relational aspect of meat and the instrument. So that the way we cook and serve food predisposes us to the use of a certain utensil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or that a certain utensil necessitates a particular mode of preparation and service. So an example of this is temperature. If you're eating with your hands, for instance, then the food has to be warm, otherwise you burn yourself. And chopsticks enable the eater to eat food that is sizzling hot, but because the food is often served in small pieces, it grows cold quite quickly.
Okay, so we're already getting into the concept of a food system, but the food system being the plate, the eater, the meat, the ambient temperature, and the thing that you're eating with. So even in this relatively simple act of discussing like a utensil, we're understanding that food is already relational just because of the ways that it has to interact with all the stuff that gets it into our mouth.
Exactly. Exactly. And that brings us to the size of the food item. So they're determined by how we eat. So when we're using a knife or a fork, cutting can be done at the table on a hard surface. This is where plates come in. So food items can be bigger. But when you use the hand or the chopstick, all of this cutting happens offstage, as it were.
In the kitchen, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So here, eaters are looking for pieces that can be eaten in one go. You can place a food object temporarily in your own individual bowl, but it's a no-go for putting it in the common plate. That's for obvious reasons. Actually, Roland Barthes was a really big fan of chopsticks, and he wrote about it in The Empire Signs. And he writes, "The instruments never pierce, cut, slits, it never wounds, but only selects, turns, shifts.
So a chopstick is a very different kind of implement in his thinking.
Yeah, and his description of the way that we eat vegetables with chopsticks by sort of unraveling the vegetable, or the way that we eat fish by kind of understanding the natural fissures of the food and sort of unwrapping it, so to speak.
Unwrapping it from its carcass, from the bones?
Yeah. 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 Okay. So utensils alone did not determine the size of a food item. For instance, Belt clearly admires the elegance and the delicacy of the chopstick-assisted gesture, but dexterity is not limited to this utensil alone. Visser describes hands that can be silent. I hadn't thought about that, that when one eats with the hands as opposed to cutlery.
Of course. There's no cling, cling, cling of the things tapping against other hard surfaces. The fingers are soft, and if they pick things up, they're probably a bit more controlled than using a knife and a fork, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was one of the things that was quite shocking about forks to begin with, where it was the noise factor for people hearing what forks did. And Visser describes, hands that can be silent, sensitive to texture and temperature and graceful, but forks can be really elegant as well. Fork users pride themselves on being able to load peas onto the back of a fork as yes. opposed to using it like a shovel.
Mm-hmm.
But with every utensil comes a long list of what to do and what not to do. And that list, I think this is important, changes over time and space.
How do you mean?
Well, what was acceptable in 1700s England in terms of fork usage may not be now.
I remember, I think, reading in the Canterbury Tales, the wife of Bath was very good at putting things into her mouth with her fork without ever letting it touch her lips, sticking very delicate pieces of flesh into her mouth from a long, long-handled fork.
Yes, and knives in particular. Their role has really changed over time from being really the main utensil that we use at the table. And its role has been restricted bit by bit. Even the shape of knives have changed. They've become a lot more rounded. The actual work of cutting has been relegated to the steak knife. There are a lot of things at the table in various countries that Visser points out that you do not do or is not done with a knife. So in France, you do not cut lettuce with a knife. It has to be torn ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And in Germany, you don't use your knife to cut starchy foods like potatoes. And God forbid, you should use a knife to cut spaghetti.
These things, particularly once you're inside your own food culture, these things become invisible.
Yes.
And so what you're doing here is, like many of us in food studies, is making things more visible that we've just taken to be normal or mundane.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it, you will see suddenly that these things are not just cutting objects, but they have mutated over the years to become more adapted to our very bone-free, gristle-free, fat-free ways of eating in North America that tend to make things incredibly soft, skinless, boneless chicken breast that you can practically eat with a spoon.
Mm-hmm. Now, the question remains, do you have a favorite utensil that you like to eat with?
I have a little tiny teaspoon that I stole from one of my residences when I was working and living in Italy. It's not a particularly nice spoon, but I love that I stole it.
Yeah. I think I tend to prefer these kinds of utensils that are a combination of things. So for instance, I really like the grapefruit spoon because it is a knife and a spoon in one.
It's a terrifying object. When I first discovered it, I almost cut my tongue out because I didn't realize it was serrated on one side or all the way around. It's a mean utensil, but you love it.
It's like a dangerous spork.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A dangerous spork.
Yeah.
Well, listeners, with that, we're going to come back to the written word as we talk to Ryan and Elizabeth about meat and not just how you eat it, but how it implicates a whole bunch of other stuff in the universe of food systems. Ryan Phillips is a sessional lecturer in politics and public administration at Toronto Metropolitan University. His research focuses on advertising and promotional cultures, particularly with regard to plant-based meat and sports broadcasting in Canada. Elizabeth Abergel is a professor in the Department of Sociology at l'Université du Québec à Montréal and is an interdisciplinary researcher in health, society, and environmental issues. Together, they guest-edited the themed section, Introducing Meat Studies, in the March 2024 issue of Canadian Food Studies. Well, Ryan, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us on Digesting Food Studies. You both guest edited a past issue of Canadian Food Studies focused on meat studies. And I'd love to start just with that as a question. Like, what is meat studies, or how is it a subsection of food studies? Is it a subsection of food studies? How does it relate? And why has it come to your attention recently as an important area of research?
So we kind of both came to this idea of meat studies, you know, a couple of years ago now. Just we were both kind of working on relatively similar projects in relatively similar areas, kind of looking at critical investigations of meat. What is it? Is it a product? Is it a process? Is it a technological promise? And yeah, we kind of both independently, I guess, sort of realized that there are a lot of scholars, you know, not just over the last few years, but the last few decades doing similar things, not only studying meat itself as an area of study, but as a concept within food studies, within science and technology studies, within political economy, and a few other, you know, interrelated disciplines. So yeah, so this really came about with us wanting to bring together a lot of these scholars who were studying more or less the same thing, but maybe from different theoretical lenses, from different disciplinary backgrounds, and who were in a lot of senses talking past one another, publishing in different areas, going to different conferences, and sometimes talking about the same thing, but not really, you know, in conversation or concert with one another. So have a richer conversation.
Yeah, very interesting. So like food studies, it's a coherent thing, but it's also transecting many other spaces.
Yeah, it's definitely interdisciplinary. And that's what makes it so interesting, because you can look at it from a variety of disciplines and multiple methodologies as well. I think the idea of doing the meat studies special issue was also to scope out who was doing what on meat. And so that was really interesting as well, like just to see, because we certainly have our own takes on how we study meat. But it was another thing to try and understand how different people in different disciplines and sub-disciplines actually do it. So that was very interesting.
Yeah, well, I'd imagine that as food studies was 40 years ago, there wasn't this kind of cross conversation that you're mentioning now, that people didn't know the other people who are also doing similar kinds of things. I mean, evidently, it's enormously timely as a subject. It's on the minds, it's on the mouths of consumers, of policymakers, of climate change specialists, of everybody who's thinking and wondering about how food systems intersect with and have impacts on the rest of our human systems. What do you think are some of the main drivers of interest in academic meat studies?
Well, I think that the meat studies, it is at the intersection of so many of our global crises that we're facing today, whether it's just food availability, whether it's resources, whether it's climate, water, whether it's pandemics, you know, whether it's animal ethics. So it really crosses a whole range of interests and it's just this sort of intersecting interest that it, you know, it represents.
As you say in the introduction to the theme section, it's also a complement or a counterpoint to vegan studies or to other areas of food studies that are specific to practices or ethical systems or concerns around environmental and human social relations.
Yeah, I think that the consumption or production and consumption of meat or the aversion to meat is still part of meat studies, because then we're dealing with, you know, alternative meats or fake meats or however you want to call them. It really boils down to how you define meat.
Yeah, we should say to clarify too, because like I myself identify as vegan. I've been vegan for about 15 years now. But like when we say that vegan studies and meat studies are sort of counters to one another, it's more so that they're two sides of a very similar coin, not necessarily positioned politically against one another.
Occupying a space and enabling a discourse from one angle or another, I guess. Yeah.
Vegan studies sort of presupposes what we mean by meat and kind of runs from there. Whereas the idea of meat studies is taking a closer look at that underlying understanding and that underlying concept of what we mean by meat and all these different, you know, technological or cultural or economic facets.
You mentioned earlier, Ryan, the idea that meat is an object, but it's also a process. And that seems, for people maybe outside of food studies or outside of science and technology studies, not so intuitive. Could you say a little bit more about what you meant by that?
I'm actually working on part of this for a book manuscript myself now, too, with the idea of plant-based meat, right? So when plant-based meat first popped up on the scene a few years ago now, I was kind of seen as this oxymoronic way of just advertising veggie burgers. But the more we kind of took seriously these claims that some of these plant-based meat companies were making, breaking down what we mean by meat at a chemical or a nutritional level, like meat is really just, you know, water and some fats and some acids. You start to think of meat not necessarily as just coming from particular places, like from animals. Well, maybe it's a process. Maybe it's just turning these different components into something new. And it's more so the process that matters than where the actual individual elements are coming from.
It's also an interpretation of value in some ways. We talk about nut meats and sweet meats and various things that are not animal fiber, but they have depth and substance and presumably some economic value and some cultural and culinary value too. And it certainly penetrates our language in many non-edible ways, that getting into the meat of the matter and all these expressions that have to do with the chewiness of that substance. In terms of next directions for meat, Elizabeth, you mentioned technocratic solutions about non-animal-based meats or meats grown not on an animal in cell culture labs.
Well, I mean, if you read my book, I'm very critical of that particular technology. But what I think is interesting about it is that it's a vehicle to try and understand, when you're trying to make animal meat outside of an animal, what does that mean? What does that represent? What does it signify? I think that in that sense, you can understand meat in multiple ways. And you can, and what is the relationship of meat to the body? Not just the body of the eater, but also the body of the eaten. So there are all these relationships. So I think that meat is also a set of relationships. It's not just a product or a process, but, you know, the animal's relationship to the eater, to the farmer, to the land, et cetera, to the rural countryside, to, you know, so there are all these different types of relationships that meat kind of evokes. And you mentioned symbolic, cultural, social, et cetera. So there are all these different ways of understanding meat as process, as product, but also as a set of relationships.
That also certainly ties into a lot of the other ways that we are gradually starting to understand food more generally and food studies more generally, that it is relationships fundamentally, and that it also produces outputs like things that we eat, but also things that we don't eat that are still outputs that are a sense of identity and belonging and culture and history, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and I think that cell meat in particular is really asking sort of more ontological questions about what is life. Because, you know, you're starting with, you're trying to emulate something, you know, outside of a body's animal, but you're trying to recreate nature in a bioreactor, let's say. So it poses a whole set of ontological questions about what are we actually doing? Who are we doing it for? And, you know, is this a real strategy? Is this a real solution to our problems? Or is it just a, you know, techno fix? And I think that those are very important questions. And those apply also to the meat, to the plant meat world as well, but more so in the animal, because there's this direct link to biomedical engineering, but also to humans, because we're mammalians and, you know, we could be meat, right?
Yeah. Everything is food. Well, this is wonderful, because as we examine food, as we examine meat, we get into these wonderful epistemic and ontological questions. We unfortunately can't spend all the time in the world talking about them right now. But one last question for you both is, was there anything that surprised you or that delighted you or that came as an aha moment in editing this section of the journal? Were there any of the articles that made you go, oh, I hadn't thought about that before?
Yeah, there were a few. I mean, first of all, it was just really nice to see the influx of, you know, submissions, because, you know, when we were originally putting this together, we thought, well, hopefully we get enough to have an actual edited volume that we can assemble. But yeah, we got quite a few submissions that we were really pleased to see. I was particularly struck by, I think it was the Rosine article on different, you know, energy considerations around cultured meat and then lab-grown meat. And the sort of nuances about, well, you know, the question is really, well, is plant-based meat actually better than, you know, animal-based meat? Like, what's, you know, what's better? And the question of what's better, it's not a really black or white ants, or there are gradients within that. Yeah. And similarly, so, you know, that's kind of what the article was talking about in the edited version as well. It's not really a question of whether or not, you know, cell-based meat or lab-grown meat is better for the environment or worse for the environment. It really depends on the production method. It really is going to depend on which type of meat you're talking about. So there are all these kinds of shades of gray that really need further focus and much more critical insights into. So that was really cool to see from my perspective, at least.
Yeah, from my perspective, along with what Ryan just said, was how political meat is, not just in terms of party affiliation or ideological thinking, but all the articles in one way or another dealt with some kind of political aspect of meat. And to me, that was really interesting because it really enriched, you know, the analysis, the critical discourse around meat. So because you could take it from so many different points of view and you could really apply, you know, a political lens, even if you're talking about meat as people's preferences between plant-based or animal meat, there's also, you know, not just a simple taste issue there, I mean, which is also very important. But I think it's really about biopolitics. It's really about, you know, eating and the choices that we make and how they impact the future, the present.
The personal is political and the meaty is political. So it's a great insight to draw out of this issue. Thank you both so much for sharing your time, your wisdom, and your editorial expertise in creating this particular section. It's a wonderful part of the journal, and I'm so glad that we could talk to you about it.
Yeah, thank you. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you very much, David.
Finally, we finish on an umami note with the aftertaste, in which grad student Emma Paisley gives us her thoughts on the article Meat Politics at the Dinner Table, written by Emily Kennedy, Cheyenne Bauman, and Jose Johnson. It's just one of the 7 articles that appear in the Meat Studies section of the journal, so be sure to check out the link in the show notes to see what else is on offer in this issue of Canadian Food Studies.
My name is Emma Paisley, and I am a PhD student in the Interdisciplinary Social Research Program at Trent University. My research investigates the ecology of food learning within a university campus foodscape. My research focuses on place-based experiential learning and critical food systems education, particularly how it intersects with agroecology, food sovereignty, and food justice. My research also touches on the hidden curriculum and how informal and formal learning across campus settings shapes students' engagement with food systems, as well as how university foodscapes can function as sites of prefrigative politics and social transformation. This article's exploration of public attitudes towards meat production and consumption, particularly the tensions that exist between widespread enjoyment of meat and concerns about potential ethical and environmental impacts, resonates deeply with the critical pedagogical aims of my research. The identification of a meat paradox and the gap between consumers' values and their behaviors directly align with my concerns about how experiential food education often stops short of generating actual change. The authors highlight how consumers may feel ethically conflicted, yet they continue their habitual consumption patterns, which mirrors how some campus experiential learning initiatives might promote sustainability without challenging dominant paradigms. This article also highlights the importance of agricultural literacy and helps frame public perception as a starting point, while my hope for my research is to push the boundaries of agricultural literacy from knowing about agriculture to engaging critically and collectively in transforming it. This helped me consider how student discomfort or the cognitive dissonance around food choices presents an ideal moment for more critical education, and how curriculum design might more explicitly engage with these tensions. The article also reinforced the need to move beyond individual ethics and taste preferences toward a collective, politicized pedagogy in food education. This article is an excellent resource for researchers who are hoping to understand the political and ideological landscape of Canadian attitudes towards meat, for policymakers who are designing evidence-informed food policy that accounts for consumer preferences and ethical concerns, and for educators who can use these consumer contradictions, or what the authors refer to as the meat paradox, as a way to further engage students to critically examine how they engage with the food system. This article offers a compelling case for integrating attitudinal and behavioral insights into curriculum design, and this work would be an excellent case to prompt student discussion around the gap between belief and action, and to explore how structural change, such as institutional procurement or policies in the support of local food, might support more aligned practices.
Well, I think we've gnawed on the chops and the ribs and the hocks of meat studies long enough for one episode, don't you? Anyway, whatever bones and cartilage remain, we'll pop them into a big pot on the back of the stove with some aromatics and see what additional goodness we can extract. While that's simmering, check out the full issue of Canadian Food Studies to meet up with some more meat studies authors. Later in the season, I'll also be talking with Kelsey Speakman about her article on alternative meat discourses and the finances of flexitarianism, just in case you haven't gotten your fill yet. Thanks very much to today's guests, Alexia Moyer, Elisabeth Epergel, Ryan Phillips, and Emma Paisley. The music for the show comes from Alex Goose and Evgeny Bardyuja on Pixabay, and our executive producers are Rachel Engler-Stringer, Laurence Godin, Charles Levko, Phil Loring, and Kristen Lowett. I'm David Santo. Take a look at the show notes for links to Canadian Food Studies and the Canadian Association for Food Studies. We've also got more info there about Alexia's literary references and Elizabeth's book, Dead Meat, Competing Vitalities, Cultivated Meat Imaginaries, and Anthropocene Diets. If you want to become part of the conversation, connect with us on social media or think about submitting an article or an artwork to the journal. And please, do your meat studies duty and like or review this episode so that others can find the podcast and enjoy it as well. Coming up this season, we're talking to all sorts of food studies authors, so feel free to jump around in the episodes, share them with students and professors and community members, and even tell your parents. Everyone is welcome to tuck in. And remember, salt and pepper perk up almost every savory dish, though piment d'espelette and miso butter make you look fancy.